Welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, I speak to adopted adult Rebecca. This was a fascinating conversation with Rebecca as she shared her story of being mixed race and adopted by a white family. Rebecca reflects a lot on growing up to lots of questions around her family and the obvious differences, especially at school and with her peers. We also discuss identity and how Rebecca found her place in the world. We talked about the importance of language, and Rebecca also shared that the use of language to her is a relatively new thing. This is Rebecca's story and her reflections. It was fascinating to talk to her and to ponder her reflections after we chatted. If you would like to share your story, whether you're an adult who was adopted, foster care, adoptive parent, care experienced, special guardian, kinship care, then please drop us a message on our socials or by email. andfpodcast@gmail.com. That's andfpodcast@gmail.com.
So I'm joined today by Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Hello. We've just been chatting, actually, and I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. This is part of the conversations, which are conversations episodes, which kind of focusing on specific experiences of adoption. So do you want to make a start by introducing yourself to us and kind of why you would be wanting to take part in such a podcast?
Sure. Well, firstly, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be speaking with you this afternoon. I'm Rebecca. I'm in my early 40s and I was born in North London in 1978. And unfortunately, my birth mother couldn't look after me properly, and that became apparent fairly quickly. And so when I was 10 months old, I was taken into emergency foster care, and I was placed with a family just outside London. I was only ever meant to be there for one night, but I actually ended up staying there forever. And that family, that family adopted me when I was 3 years old. And one of the important pieces of my story, or parts of my story, is that I'm mixed race. My birth mother was a young white English woman. When I was born, or when I was younger, everything about my father was unknown, but it was clear that he was black. But as I said, yeah, back then we didn't know. So I was a mixed race baby with a single young birth mother, white birth mother, and then went and was subsequently looked after by a white family and adopted by that family. And so, as we were saying before, we were talking about language and how people like to define themselves. And so I think I understand that that might be called a transracial adoption. But that's actually not a label or, you know, phraseology that I've used. I've always just kind of said, oh, well, I'm mixed race and my family's white. But yeah, that's kind of the beginning of my story, I guess.
Yeah. And it's quite, I mean, what struck me when I read about that was it was unusual of its time to be, well, maybe not unusual, but certainly unusual when we relate to current adoption in terms of neglect or abuse and stuff, because clearly your experience is that you were being neglected at that point in time. And that's why that's where the story started to unfold, I guess. So do you feel like a connection to kind of the modern day adoption? And I'm putting my fingers in the way in the air there to say that, you know, I don't think adoption is, you know, it's different in many ways, but it's the same in a lot. Do you feel like a connection to the current process, you know, et cetera?
Well, I think everyone's story is different and personal. I think what's interesting is that there have obviously been changes. And I don't know if this is particularly what you're alluding to, but the fact that I was and could be adopted by a white family, and that wasn't seen as a huge issue. In fact, it was almost, I always kind of say, it was really glossed over. In a way that I don't think it would be today. My parents certainly weren't given any kind of specific support or resources about the fact that they were now responsible for bringing up a mixed race little girl, it was almost as though, great, you know, she's safe now, you love her, you're white, she's brown, oh, let's not worry about that too much, goodbye and good luck. I always kind of think about it, yeah, off you go. And so what then, and I think, you know, thinking about the UK back in the 80s, really, when I was in the 80s into the 90s, and the whole kind of just the broader dialogue around race and things like that, I was definitely in a family in a wider environment where there was an element of, well, let's just not think about it. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to us. It's kind of how my family would see it. And I think there's definitely an element of colorblindness, which I think in, again, more current times, that's kind of not okay either. Yeah. But I definitely appreciate my family were only doing the best that they could with the understanding and knowledge that they had. And also, because we didn't know anything about who or where my birth father was from, well, what do we tag onto? You know, we can't just kind of pick a culture and say, well, I mean, you might do that and say, well, this is what we'll go with. So that was, you know, I can speak very lightheartedly about it now, but it was really something that caused a great deal of pain growing up because, you know, I'm visibly brown and it would be one of the first questions I was often asked by children and adults alike all the time. Where are you from? Where are you from? And what they really meant was, where is your father from? Right. And so that would subsequently, you know, this started very early, these feelings of shame. You know, it's kind of layer upon layer of like, oh, you know, I'm adopted and then I'm, you know, mixed race and a white family. And then I don't even know where I'm from, you know. And when you're growing up and trying to find that sense of stability and identity, I didn't have any of that stuff. And so it was actually very wounding in a lot of ways. And it took me a long time as an adult to really come to terms with that properly and be proud of who I am, rather than completely buying into that notion of shame that I wasn't good enough and that I didn't belong because of some of those reasons.
That's interesting. And as a Scottish person myself, growing up in an area that was, you know, we didn't have any people of colour. You know, that was just the way it was. I'm always intrigued to listen to these experiences and these stories. And I did read, and I say read, it was from America, so it might not be relevant. But there's sometimes when the story went that, you know, sometimes when people of colour are adopted by white and vice versa, you know, that does happen as well, that there's also an element of colour blindness from the person who's been adopted as well. So did you feel that? I mean, you said the word colorblindness. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but, you know, forgive me for that if it's not. But
no.
You
know, what I'm hearing from you, definitely, I, for a long time, identified as white, fully white. And that was something that was, I don't want to say encouraged, but to some extent by my family. You know, when you have those forms and you have to tick the box and never knew what to tick. And this was, I mean, having even options like mixed, that's a relatively new thing. That wasn't happening back in the 90s. And so I remember having this kind of inner dialogue of, well, what does ethnicity mean? Like, do they mean culturally? If it's culturally, then yes, I'm culturally white. Yeah. and so I definitely... For years, I would joke with my close friends, I am white. And it's only in recent years I've realized how, you know, kind of not okay and actually painful in its own way that is, because I was denying a big chunk of myself and also denying or not wanting to acknowledge how the outside world views me. Because that's a reality that I was trying to just think, well, you know, that's nothing to do with me, when of course it is.
Yeah. So thinking about your childhood, and I mean, you know, school and all those kinds of things, not to mention, you know, you're kind of cocooned and loved, and, you know, it's not an issue within the hub of the home. So what was it like leaving the home? You know, I mean, what was your experience where that was concerned?
The word that comes to mind is visible. I always felt very visible. And not for the right reasons. So, yeah, just going out to, as a family, out for the day, or, you know, being on school parent evenings, you know, when the school at large, they're all there, and you're putting your hands on your head in your hands.
Oh, that I can't even kind imagine of thing.
It would be like, days. And the eyes, you could feel the eyes on. Mm-hmm. And so I found that I just wanted to disappear, Scott. Like, I really just wanted to be, like all kids, you just want to blend in, don't you? You want to be like everyone else. And I just wasn't. And I think, you know, I was very aware or perceptive of a lot of the kind of judgment around me. And there's a lot of judgment about adoption anyway, as I'm sure you're aware. Even today, you know, I hear ridiculous things that people, kind of questions that people ask around adoption or assumptions that people make. But I do, you know, I can only speak from my personal experience, and the race component was a really big part of that. And one of the anecdotes that I sometimes share is that one time I was at the dentist and my dad had come to kind of check me in and was chatting away to the receptionist. And then he went off to do some shopping while I waited. And she was, you know, she was just an incredibly nosy woman. You could tell immediately. As soon as my dad had disappeared, she's like, so who is that to you? And I'm like, oh, yeah, here we go. So I said, oh, that's my dad. And she just, you know, there was a beat and she looked aghast and she said, oh, is your mum black? And this type of interaction, it, you know, it wasn't commonplace, but it wasn't unusual. You know, it was never too far from the surface. People really wanted to know what's going on here. And as I said, making judgments about me and my life.
And what about your kind of peers at school? I mean, you know, I know as a gay man growing up, it was bloody hard going through school. Anything that was different about, you know, anybody within school was picked up on. I mean, is that your experience? And, you know, how do you see that? Was that your experience? How did you cope with it then? And then I'll ask you more after that. Sorry. I'm so intrigued by it.
When I was little, so infant primary, yes. And also, you know, you're at that age where kids certainly don't have a filter. They're inquisitive and they don't have a filter. So there would be questions like, why are you brown and your mummy's white? And, you know, kids, their mum would kind of be hush, hush, hush. And me and my mum would try and make a joke of it. So I remember those kind of things when I was little. Funnily enough, say when we get to secondary school, not so much. I went to a predominantly white school. I think in my year, I was deaf, maybe one of two mixed race teenagers, children. And, you know, like maybe five people in the year, if I'm remembering rightly, who were non-white. But that it wasn't, nobody, I'm laughing because I had a terrible time at school, but it wasn't to do with my adoption and it wasn't to do with my race. I ended up being quite badly bullied from around 13 to 15 was the worst time. But it wasn't for those reasons. But what I kind of reflect back on, I think, you know how bullies, they kind of look for the weakest ones in the pack. And I think because of my experiences to date, and because of some of my upbringing, I mean, my parents they are 42 years older than me. And so again, this is another layer of difference. In 78, you know, in the early 80s, people weren't having small children in their 40s, not to the level now. And so I had much older parents than my peers. And because of, you know, generationally, they were very old school in their outlook, and my mum was very strict, and so all of this, I remember some girls when I was in year, what is now year seven, so 11, 12, saying, oh, you know, we need to teach you how to be cool. Here are the five top things you need to do. It's like homework on how you can be cool. I didn't fit in properly. I definitely got bullied, but it wasn't because I was adopted or that I was mixed race. But no one wants to be different at school.
Most definitely not. No, that's and so I have so many questions, really, but I think it's mainly about your, because I could talk to you about school and everything. Was there a point where you went, okay, there's like a mixed match here, as in your parents are white, and you're mixed. And was there a defining moment where you went, okay, I get this, or not?
I do have this lasting memory, because people will often say, did you always know you're adopted? And I'll say, well, I'm brown and my parents are white, so the jig was up fairly early on. And my parents were always very open about that. But in terms of recognizing or kind of being cognizant of this difference, I have this lasting memory of, I guess I would have been about four, of like looking in the mirror. I don't know what I was doing, just mucking around, but looking in the mirror. And it was almost as though in that moment, and nothing had happened, but this penny dropped. There was that moment of understanding that, and I can remember my small little face. It's very strange. And I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that it possibly meant something not good. There was that kind of instinct of, something's up with this.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to articulate it. I don't know if I'm doing it,
doing
it now, but it was definitely, that's remained with me, that memory.
Hmm. That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of like, there's a few things that you're saying, and I'm just like, oh, that must be how my kids feel, having two dads, you know, because obviously, clearly from the beginning, you know, they had two dads. So how could two dads have a child, you know, that kind of thing?
And it was
like that, so that made them different. We may have been the same color, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's kind of clear points of difference as well. So, yeah, you've got me thinking that again. I love doing these. So, and I wouldn't normally ask about your parents, but I don't know whether they're still with us or not. But was there ever a point where they kind of went, "Oh, you've had it rough. You've had it tough." Or did it not, because of the kind of, you know, within your cocoon and your little, you know, family hub, it just never came up? Or and if that's too personal, sorry, I'm really interested to know kind of how they would have adjusted over time. You know, I mean, 70s, 80s, 90s is a, you know, it was tough times for everything, really.
I know.
Don't know what I'm trying to say there, but you know what I mean.
I do, absolutely. My mum is still with us. My dad sadly passed away a couple of years ago. What I do remember is when I was little, my mum, because I was, as I said, I was with my family from 10 months and then I was formally adopted at three. And we had this big party. My mum told me later that around the time, like the night before the adoption or the night of, she was kind of had this moment in the garden of just feeling like, have we done the right thing?
Right.
Not in terms of, she felt, are we being selfish? Have we done the right thing for her? And I know that my dad said a few things to me when I was in my kind of mid-teens around, he was worried about my race and the impact that might have on, you know, my life, in terms of being able to get a job and all of those kind of things. Because, you know, he's grown up he was born in the mid-30s.
Yeah.
And then been a young adult man in the 50s where you're seeing signs, you know, no blacks, no Irish. So their view of the world to then suddenly have, because my parents didn't know any black people. It's not like they were living some kind of cosmopolitan life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that really hard when he would say things like that to me, because he was saying it from a place of love and almost, you know, him wanting to prepare me. But I was like, God, you know, if you're telling me it's going to be difficult, what hope have I got? But in terms of my adoption, I don't know that there was never any, you've had it tough or anything like that. Not to say that they didn't think that, but they're just not the kinds of people that would articulate it. I mean, I find it really interesting in a good way. I understand now that as part of the adoption process, counselling is a big part of that on both sides, and there's a lot more emotional support during the adoption process and continuing on. There was none of that. There was not one thing. And at no point would my parents, again, they're of a generation, talking about things just makes things worse. You know, just let's just brush everything under the carpet and forget about it. So I think, well, I know it's incredible. You can't go through this kind of early trauma or abandonment or all of the things associated with adoption. You're not going to come out of it unscathed. It's just the reality. And so I'm pleased to hear that it does seem that there's more support around the emotional well-being of kids and also the broader family. But that, you know, I would say there's probably not enough. You know, there needs to be more. Because I've definitely spent, you know, as I said, I'm in my early 40s. I had this real realization as I turned 40. It's like, God, I've spent the last 20 years really trying to get over and come to terms with everything that happened in the first 20 years of my life. And I've been in a fortunate and privileged position where I could seek out, you know, going to see a hypnotherapist here, going to see a talking therapist here, a bit of Reiki here and there. I mean, I've tried it all, Scott. but, you know, obviously not everyone has those opportunities. And I think that's a real sadness.
Yeah. And it's funny because you've just led into where I was going to go with this. And that was about the kind of the trauma and the effects of, you know, you mentioned the word abandonment. I mean, how did that manifest for you? You know, did it like, was there a point where it started to happen? Did you see that's what it was?
I think it was always there, like really feelings of insecurity and not being safe have been big themes of my life. I had in my family, I have two big sisters who are my parents' biological children. And because of my parents' age, my middle sister is 14 years older than me, and my big sister's 18 years older than me. So yeah, here's another difference for everyone. But what that meant is I grew up with effectively kind of two sets of parents, like these four adults. And I remember when my eldest sister got married, I was 8 years old. And quite unusually, she'd actually stayed at home until she got married in her late 20s. Back then, that was unusual. And I was just devastated. It was such a loss to me, her leaving. And I've always struggled. I've got better as I got older, but struggled with leaving or people leaving me.
Right.
So absolutely. And low self-esteem and all of that stuff. And, you know, I was a classic girl who would, by the time she was a teenager, maybe a bit before, would use humor. You know, I've been doing it this afternoon. I use humor a lot. I always have to deflect. But yeah, like it has been tough. It has been tough, and it's manifested in lots of ways. You know, kind of eating for comfort from a very young age. So being a chubby kid didn't help. And then getting to uni and realizing the world of booze. And, you know, just kind of partying all the time. And I look back, I have a lot of empathy and compassion for my younger self, because I can see she was really quite hurt and just wanted to be accepted. But I wasn't prepared to accept myself. And I think that's probably one of the biggest learnings as you get older and you do start to really get into true healing.
Yeah, and with all those layers, adoption, race, you know, like you've just said there, older parents, you know, it would be Well, I'm guessing it would be hard to work out what it was that was kind of having the impact more than anything else. Well, maybe, I don't know, you know.
It just felt like all of it is heavy. Yeah, I mean, as you kind of list more of it, I can feel it, you know. I have such problems with my shoulders and my back. And I actually had some Reiki earlier today, and we were talking about this, the weight of the world. And it can sound a bit dramatic, and I don't mean it to, but it did feel like, oh my God, like I'm just... It's too much. I need, catch me a break. I need a break somewhere in this.
Yeah.
When I was younger. And that's why I pinned so much, I know I did, on running away to university. That's how I saw it. And you just need to get out of here and leave all of this behind where no one knows me and I can be whoever I choose to be.
Yeah.
It didn't end up being as simple as that, but it was definitely the start.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you what, because I think there's a lot of discussion about fogged adoptees and people who were adopted who kind of get to a certain age and then they start to see their adoption in a different light and all that sort of stuff. I mean, obviously there has been a point for you with that, and it sounds like it happened earlier. Do you think that continues? And you know, I don't know where I'm going with this question, but it just strikes me as it must be so difficult to kind of think, okay, this happened, and I'm putting it very simplistically, I don't mean to, but this happened, this is what I'm going to do about it, this was the outcome or wasn't the outcome, and this is how I'm going to live my life. Is that, you know, because you sound like you might be that kind of person that does it like that. I don't know.
A control freak, you mean?
That's maybe one of the side effects, you know.
Well, no, I'm a self-confessed control freak. What I would say is, and as this is with the benefit of, you know, getting older, the lens changes. Right. And it changes for me, at least, through the life experience that you have. And so my birth mother did actually get in touch unprompted when I was 21. And that threw a little bit, not a bomb, but maybe like a little grenade off, because it really upset my parents. And I was at uni, I was doing my finals. I'm like, where's this come from? And so we had a couple of letters back and forth. We never met in person. I didn't want to at that point. And, you know, I finally got to ask the question, who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Who is this man that everyone's been asking me about my whole life? Mm. And my birth mother had said that it was a short-lived relationship. His name was this, and he was from Jamaica. Right. And I have a country, at least. Mm. The name seemed strange because it was unusual. And the short-lived relationship, well, you're talking to a girl who's in her final year at university.
Yeah.
And so my read of that was, oh, okay, so it's a one-night stand. That's what, I made some assumptions about that letter. It's like, it's a one-night stand. I'm not sure you know this guy's name. And so therefore, I don't know if I believe the Jamaica piece either.
Right.
And so it didn't kind of end up being, now we can tie this all up in a bow. It actually cause more questions, more like, oh, I'm never going to know. But what I would say then, you know, jump forward another 20 years, and I had my daughter when I was 40, you know, I was never going to be an older parent. No, that will not happen. And of course it did. And it happened as it should. But when I had my daughter, you became a mother for the first time. You start to look at things through that lens. Mm. And I definitely began to have more compassion and understanding, perhaps, my birth mother through that experience. The benefit of being a bit older, definitely, coupled with having my own child. Mm. And also cutting her a bit of slack that maybe she wasn't lying. Maybe she wasn't, you know, maybe that was that phrase that's going to, you know, maybe that was her truth. Mm. And so I also felt a real responsibility to my daughter. My husband is white. And I I didn't want my daughter to ever have to answer those, not be able to answer those questions in the way that I had. I mean, we live in North London, really. No one cares. No one cares. Yeah, life is
a life different
is,
now, isn't it?
It's, you know, life has moved on. But yeah. I remember very clearly being heavily pregnant, walking down the street thinking, you know what, I get to make some choices. I get to decide. And I, as a younger person, particularly as a child and teen, I always felt I had to tell the truth. So people would ask me questions and I'd be like, oh, now I have to tell them my whole life. And I would, what was I doing? I don't know. Whereas, as I said, when I was pregnant, I thought I can decide. My birth mother said that I'm half Jamaican. Know what? I'm half Jamaican. And I'm going to really just lean into that and own it. And I went off to Jamaica, and that sounds a bit like impulsive and random, but it was more just, than
you
off
got the
I
bus
go.
Out Heathrow.
Yeah, off I go. It was more, I'm very into synchronicities and there not being coincidences, and I'm very spiritual. And when around the time that I made this choice, Jamaica started appearing in different forms in my life. Right. And then an opportunity very naturally presented itself for me to go. And so I did. And that really has been such a big part of my healing, that acknowledgement that, because being able to, put a label on myself and belong to something. And what's been really, really key, and I didn't see it coming, but with the reemergence of the Black Lives Matters campaign last year, that completely pulled the rug from under me. And it was almost as though I'd been getting on with lockdown pretty happily, just kind of doing my own thing. And when that happened, it was as though this is your reckoning. This is the piece of the puzzle of my story that you've been suppressing and not wanting to deal with. And so I think with those things around, like, as I said, the Jamaica piece and my daughter being born and all of this stuff, it's through this that I can finally feel, you know what, I am mixed race and I am brown, and I'm really proud of that. I'm proud of that part of my heritage in a way that I hadn't been before.
Yeah. And rightly so. Not about your daughter. I don't want you to talk about her, but what was that like when you had your daughter? I mean, your first connection to your own biology.
I know. Someone who's related to me by blood. And, it was, I'd gone to have some acupuncture as when I was
you'd gone well with my husband, he loves all that.
I just love it. I was having acupuncture when I was trying to get pregnant, and I had a gorgeous acupuncturist. She specialized in fertility, and the first couple of sessions were all about healing the mother wound, which I wasn't expecting. I thought I'd show up and she'd stick some needles in me.
Yeah.
And so that was really important. Of course, it makes sense as I say it, but going through that process a bit to really, I was essentially, with all the other healing and work that I'd done, I was ready to have my daughter. I was ready to be the kind of mother that I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's parenting, as you will know, is a work in progress.
Oh,
but,
yes.
But one of the things that's been a real, real gift, and I think my husband is very loving and supportive of this, because everyone we meet, whether it's someone we know or an absolute stranger, she's your mini me, she looks exactly like you. And for me, I have to admit, I absolutely love it. I love having someone in my life who does look like me, we're a pair. And that too has been incredibly, incredibly healing. Things like, because I've always had, issues around my body image and weight, and a lot of that, I was a really, really big baby, and I kind of been told that that was to do with the malnutrition and things like that when I was with my birth mother. And then I give birth to a 9-pounder, and I was always a big baby, and so suddenly I'm like, oh no, that's just how we're made. She is an innocent baby who's done absolutely nothing wrong. She hasn't eaten the wrong things or anything.
No. Yeah.
So it was like a mirror for me, like, you are perfect as you are. This is how the women in my line, in my family, this is how we're made. Yeah. So there's been lots of really surprising and gorgeous moments with her that are, you know, she's just healing me on a daily basis.
Oh, that, you know, that is really nice to hear, actually, because when you have that kind of approach, and you know, you talked about some of the stuff that you've done, that is really the repair side of it, isn't it? It's not solving it. It's not you know, stamping it all out, but it's certainly helping to repair some of it, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
So in terms of your education then, I mean, you know, you seem quite successful from what I read and the way you know, I mean, you got bullied. You've been honest about that. I mean, did that go all the way through university, the whole jingbang, or?
No, the bullying was just at secondary school. Yeah. University was great, mainly. I had I made some amazing friends, still friends with some of them today. I've always been very independent. And so being able to, like I said, you know, move away from home and, you know, make some mistakes and stand on my own two feet was really important. So did you have another question about education?
I was trying to gauge like how it maybe affected you throughout your education. You know, was there an inner saboteur at any points going, you can't do this, you're not worthy, you know, that kind of thing that I get all the time as a normal, like normal, that's the wrong word to use, sorry, but you know what I'm saying? Like someone who's had a secure attachment, you know, was brought up in their kind of their own family.
Well, you know, narratives, as we know, are really, really important for good or for bad. And one of the ongoing narratives in my family growing up was how clever I was. Mm. It was a constant. And there was a little bit of a legend, we don't know if it's true or not, that I was conceived in Oxford. Mm. And there's a little bit of a legend that my birth father might have been an international student at Oxford University. Well, okay. You can imagine. Because again, going back to late 70s, 80s, yes. At Oxford University, this is the girl. So my parents, I'm thinking, they loved that. And so it's one of those classic cases of this unknown figure was never demonized, and in fact, if anything, celebrated because of this potential Oxford link. I think what you tell children matters, right? Because I was always told I was clever. I was always told I'm going to university, and I'm the first person that went to university in my family. And so, funnily, for all of the different insecurities in my head, that was never in doubt. It was just which university would I go to,
right? Okay.
And what would I study? So that it was almost like you can make me feel crap about all kinds of things, but not about that. And that was my mum in particular was always very encouraging that I could do whatever I wanted to do if I put my mind to it. So no, I didn't sabotage myself in that way. Yeah. I was actually pretty focused. I guess I was always fairly ambitious from a young age.
Yeah. Well, and with the independent thing that you discussed throughout this as well, you know, it's kind of, I'm going to do this, and, you know.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm just reflecting there on what you say about the Oxford thing and stuff. Did that feel like a bit of a fairy tale story, or, you know, or does that not really impact on you that way?
I was willing to believe it. And in fact, when I was in my 20s, I guess early 20s, I got in touch with Oxford University to see. And they couldn't help me. They were so kind. Mm. And this woman I'd have been in touch with, because this was pre-email, you know, it's like letters, letter writing days. And she'd gone out to the quad or whatever and had spoken to some of the old fellows who had been there back in the day. And we came up, really kind, but we came up with a blank. But I could still believe it. I kind of, there are certain things. It's like my daughter's at nursery and she loves singing, dancing, loves dancing. And the nursery teacher said to me the other day, she's an excellent dancer. Are you a dancer? I was like, well, you know, not professional, but we do love a kitchen dance. And I've always been very musical. And it just got me thinking, you know, just about kind of ancestry and family lines. Mm. And I'm making an assumption, but I kind of assume that my musicality has come from the Black side of my family. Oh. And I just had this kind of thought of like, God, what if I had grown up in a family like that, where it was, there were loads of us and we were like always dancing in the kitchen and singing. And there was like this joyful exuberance, which again, that is the fairy tale. But I just had that. I did have one of those what if moments. Things like questions, things like that pop up at unexpected moments, unexpected ways.
Yeah. That's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So what's your future? What's happening? How are you using all this kind of experience and this, if I can just say this, positivity, actually, because you know, you may have spent 20 years fixing the first 20 years, but you know, you just seem to be like wanting to kind of, I don't know, just be you and accept what's happened in some ways. And I'm sure you have your down days about it. I'm sure you do.
Absolutely. So
what's next? How can you use this? Are you using it?
I love that you said just be you, because when I turned 40, it was like for many people, it's a real turning point. It's a new chapter, but I felt really positive about it. I was excited. I was like, this is going to be the second half of the rest of my life. But I knew that I wanted to make some changes. I was hoping to have a baby and I did, but I knew that my work wasn't fulfilling me in the way that it had. I've always worked in communications and campaigns and around communicating things that matter to us, whether it's around health or education, all that kind of social impact stuff, as it's called. Yeah. And after I had Aura, I wasn't working and went into a period of real exploration as to, if we're going to make some changes with my work, what are they going to be? And one of the things I really felt strong is that I want to be more me more of the time, because I felt that I compartmentalized myself, and I wanted to stop that. I wanted to just be fully authentic and not have to wear like corporate-y clothes, or, you know, I don't want to wear heels ever again. You know, I don't need to do that. All of that stuff.
Yeah.
But on a deeper level, I really wanted to find a way to, how could I use this kind of this spiritual aspect of me that's always been really strong, or the fact that all of these different healing modalities I've, you know, found so powerful and transformative, you know, what is in that? And so during that period of exploration, I came to realize, and it's not news, but I was kind of recognized a lot of adults trying to heal or numb or suppress the after effects of trauma from early childhood or their early years. And trauma can mean different things to different people. It doesn't have to be something, you know, a big event. And so then I got even more curious about, well, okay, if it's acknowledged that we generally don't escape from childhood unscathed to some extent, how can we interrupt childhood? How can we actually get in there when these things are happening and take some of these, you know, what I consider to be really beautiful and effective healing tools and put them in the hands of children? And so I recognize, and it's great that we're starting to see things like meditation and yoga in schools, but there's so much more. And so that's what I'm working on now. I'm in the process of launching my new business, which is called Happy Marlowe. And we're tailoring, working with child therapists and practitioners, and we're bringing breath work, emotional freedom technique, which is also known as tapping, and sound healing. And packaging it all up for 6 to 11-year-olds so that they can have some agency over their emotional journeys. And really, I know when you're growing up, you have precious little control about most things. And I think there's something really powerful if we're able to empower children to feel some control and agency over how they are feeling and understanding their emotions and managing their feelings better.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people do find that sort of stuff really useful, especially with you know, in our community, with the adoption community, because and I've experienced it myself with my youngest son, because when my older two, now they're now adults, 22 and 21, all of this stuff, you know, you talk about 1970 whenever it was, even in 2007, you know, there was no such thing as, oh well, they probably need ongoing support and on you know, yeah, therapy. Thankfully, by the time 2014 came along, it was kind of recognized, and but using things like mindfulness and you know, getting all, you know, the breathing and just getting in touch with that kind of what helps is having a husband who loves to go to Thailand and do detoxes and massages and all that sort of stuff. So that's really, that is, you know, but it's massively important that we kind of try these things as well. You know, we might not believe in them, because a lot of people don't, let's face it. But actually, if we try them and they work, then why would we not just, you know, want to continue doing that?
Exactly. Yeah. I think the main thing is to have an open mind. And what I would say, we did a pilot with 10 families at the end of last year.
Yeah.
And the kids, they don't need persuading, actually.
No, they don't.
They naturally have open minds. Like, oh, yeah, I'll try it. Oh, I slept really well. Oh, yeah, I did the tapping before my 11 plus. This is a true story. And I felt loads better. So they get it. It's you're right. There is some skepticism, and that's okay.
Yeah.
With parents. Yeah. I think the main thing is to, and because of everything that's happened this past year, I think it's been sadly a real leveler in terms of anxiety, worry, and stress. It's affecting all children.
Yeah.
And so I think, and I know that parents are looking for support. They're looking for resources. This isn't like, oh, I need to go to the GP. It's not that, but it is that I want to find some other ways to help my child. And I'm hoping my mission and my dream is that Happy Marlowe can be part of that solution.
Yeah.
And another thing I just wanted to add, because it's relevant to our conversation, for the Happy Marlowe model, it's a subscription-based approach, but for every paid subscription, one will be gifted to a child who is either in foster care or who has been adopted.
Right.
And I'm really excited by some of the different partners and organizations that we'll be working with to do that.
Yeah. Well, I haven't had a conversation in a while where I've laughed so much.
that's
probably, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, actually. You maybe just tried to deflect me into laughter.
No,
I don't know.
I'll take it as a good thing. That.
Yeah. Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing. And your story, you know, everybody's story is their own story, of course, but it's quite unique in some ways. So thank you so much for sharing it. And I do wish you all the best with Happy Marlowe, and I hope it goes really well. And the fact that, you know, you're gifting, you know, a package for each one that's purchased is that's the kind of thing we need right now, because that kind of support isn't always easily accessible, is it? So
thank you. Thanks for having me, Scott. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.